Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a lot going on here this week, but we're going to start off with, well, President Trump is over in France at the G7 meeting, but we're going to start off first with Steve Bannon, and he sort of lays out a very, very fine presentation. He was interviewed by Kyle Bass, and he lays out some of the problems with China. So here we go, starting off with Steve Bannon.
Mr. Bannon, thanks for being here at this undisclosed location in Texas.
It's Steve.
It's good to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Sorry. You know, you're here very specifically to talk with me about something that you and I study very, very intently, and it's China. Yep. And I'd love to just start right off the bat with asking you, what do you think China's true intentions are in their grand strategy? What is their grand strategy?
The grand strategy is very simple. It's to be a hegemonic world power. I mean, you see through One Belt, One Road. You can see through Made in China 2025. You can see through everything they're doing, their strategy of being like the East India Company in sub-Saharan Africa, what they're doing in the Caribbean, now what they're doing in Latin America, the economic war, what we call all forces of government, right? All areas of government focus on the economic war against the United States, their military buildup. They're basically trying to close the South China Sea. It is the most geopolitically ambitious strategy we've ever seen. Let me be very specific. The three great theories of geopolitics. You've got Mackinder's theory of the Asian landmass. You have Mahan's theory of cutting off the choke points of the world's oceans. And you have Speakman's theory of keeping your enemy off of the Asian landmass. The Chinese are the only power in world history to ever try to do all three simultaneously. You know, Napoleon and Hitler and others tried to do the Eurasian landmass. Others, the British and the American empires, the British Empire and the American, system we have today is built off Mahan's naval strategy. Mm-hmm. And then Speakman's is one from the earlier 20th century. What China is doing is with One Belt, One Road, trying to basically connect the old Silk Road all the way up to Italy. As we saw in the paper today, the Italian government, the guys in the five-star, Di Maio came back from Beijing. They had a huge thing about, hey, we want to end the One Belt, One Road in Italy where Marco Polo essentially left. We had a vote this week in the Maldives, which really rejected what they're trying to do in the Mahan strategy of taking all the naval bases and choke points throughout the world. And then Speakman, what they're trying to do is force the United States, which has been a Pacific power, off of the landmass through what they're doing in the South China Sea, what they're doing around Taiwan. They want to push us back to Guam. So listen, they're the most, people have said for years to kind of cover this. A lot of the Wall Street and City of London and Frankfurt crowd have kind of said, oh, well, you know, they're not territorially ambitious. They've never been an expansionist power. Mm. Well, they're a geopolitically expansionist power, and it's quite extraordinary what they're doing it at the same time.
And do you think that their kind of, let's say, their newfound economic greatness or their perceived greatness post-financial crisis, they always believed they were kind of a second-rate power financially going into 2008, and the world seems to believe that they were the engine of the world's growth from 2009, 2018. Is it that economic growth that they build their geopolitical assertiveness on, in your opinion?
Listen, I think it's since time immemorial, the access to the Chinese market, kind of this mystery of the Chinese market, has always drawn in the West, right? Whether it's the British coming there at first with the East India Company or later the China, you know, the China schooners from the United States, right? The China trade. It was always this thing about China. What we've seen, and I happen to believe that the Chinese economic system is built on a house of sand. And I think it's going to lead us to a greater financial debacle than 2008 ever was. And the same culprits, the exact same culprits that led to the financial crisis in 2008, the investment banks, the commercial banks, the hedge funds, the government entities, right? The same elites that led to that financial crisis and got bailed out and had no responsibility, no accountability, have been the same exact actors that have exacerbated the situation in China. And so, yes, the reason the world's elites, the party of Davos, the people on Wall Street, what I call the IR departments of China, which are the investment banks, particularly Goldman Sachs and some commercial banks, the lobbyists for China, which is the basically the 25 or 30 largest corporations that deal in China today. They're lobbyists in Washington, D.C. These are all and by the big private equity guys like Schwarzman, these guys, they're all going to have to be held accountable for what went on in China. What China was able to do in basically coordination with the elites in the West was deindustrialize the industrial democracies of the West, both Europe and the United States. That's why Brexit and 2016 are inextricably linked. Mm. What it is the exporting of Chinese overcapacity and Chinese deflation in basic industrial goods. And so China has, and from the Chinese point of view, it's been quite brilliant. They've essentially taken 350 million of their people from kind of working poverty to middle class, mm-hmm. and 400 million people from abject poverty to working poverty. So essentially two-thirds of their population, because their population I really think is closer to 1.3 or 1.4 billion than what they say in 1.1. So what they've done is heroic in 30 years, okay, from a strategy point of view. But that has been exacerbated by the elites in the West who basically kind of financed it and brought it along. In fact, what Trump, the reason Trump was, I think, so special, he said, hey, this is not the way the world has to be. It could be very different. We've basically financed the rise of China. We've built China. And all he heard for years, and what you heard for years is, no, this is the what I call the second law of thermodynamics, or this is a immutable law of physics, the rise of China. And what Trump says, no, this is through human agency. It's the commercial banks, the investment banks, the corporations, the kowtowed to the Chinese regime. And one thing I want to make sure, Kyle, I get up in front, this is not about the Chinese people. I served as a naval officer over in China, in the Western Pacific, in the 7th Fleet on a destroyer in the mid-70s. I think 76, 77 is the first time I went to China. I've been involved in China virtually all my life. I've owned businesses over there. I've lived in Shanghai for a while in the French concession. I have a great, not just admiration, but a deep love for the Chinese people. In fact, they have a saying over there called Old Hundred Names, which is basically the common man, because there's 100 last surnames in China. So Old Hundred Names is essentially the deplorables, right? And those in the Old Hundred Names is a sense of common decency, their grit, their determination. What they've been through as a people is nothing short of heroic. What we have, the problem we have, is we have a totalitarian regime of the Chinese Communist Party, and quite frankly, the leadership, the elite leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, that are really in business with the Party of Davos, which is this, you know, kind of scientific, engineering, managerial, financial, cultural elite that I say kind of emanates from the World Economic Forum in Davos, but really is in London and New York, Washington, D.C., Silicon Valley,
right,
et cetera.
And do you think the way that they've ingratiated themselves into, let's say, the Davos man, as is commonly referred to, the way that they've gotten there is it through economic coercion? Is it through investing in our universities, our think tanks, our lobbyists, as you said, and our corporations, and even the people that are U.S. citizens looking to make profits in China? Is that how they control that narrative?
Let's go back to in 1 week, in January 2017, we had two, I think, seminal speeches. Okay, we had the Davos speech, President
Xi, yeah.
Okay, which was the high hosanna to globalism.
Yeah.
And it was, to me, repulsive, repulsive, how the mainstream media and Davos man just sat there and bought it all and said, what a great leader, what a great humanitarian, what he's going to lead us through about climate, you know, on the world's environment, what he's going to do, you know, for globalization or for the economy. And then you saw Donald Trump's inaugural address was, I think, 3 days later, in which he said, hey, we're getting back to the nation state. And America is going to start to focus on our sovereignty and other nations to start thinking about their sovereignty. But this globalization and what's coming out of Davos is stripped our sovereignty from us. And we're going to reassert that. And 2 years later, which happened this week, was Mike Pence's speech about the new strategy of the United States, which has really been going along for quite a while, which is now kind of engaging China, right? An engagement with China, but not like Henry Kissinger and not like the Thucydides trap crowd. And I know you did this seminal interview with Graham Allison, but not what those guys want, which is the kind of us stumble along and play along with China. This is a direct confrontation with China to say, we're not going to take it anymore. You've been in economic war with us and we're going to reassert us. your question about how they ingratiate themselves, they're the guys who wrote the biggest checks.
Right.
They wrote checks to the universities. They wrote checks. They've essentially bought off the City of London and Wall Street and the corporations. You should know. I say this in a sense of kind of anger. The great investment banks in London and in New York became the investor relations department for this regime, okay?
In the pursuit of profits.
In the total pursuit of profits.
Yes.
And corporations became their lobbyists. When Lee Hu's deputy came to the United States about 4 weeks ago, when they had this kind of last round of trying to put something together into a trade deal, there wasn't much going on, but he sent his deputy and a small contingent to see Steve Mnuchin, the guys at Treasury. They went to, the very first stop they made was to, the day before they went to Treasury, they stopped and they had a meeting with, I think it was 15 or 20 large corporations, the heads of government affairs, and I think the presidents, not the CEOs, because the guy wasn't high enough. And he basically said, hey, boys, you have a problem, right? And you have to figure out how to help us fix it, okay? Another thing, they had, Wang Qishan announced this kind of financial advisory panel. Being on their back foot by the Trump strategy, they kind of said, hey, we need a financial advisory panel to help us understand what the United States wants the United States needs. And it was named, you know, Paulson and Schwartzman and all these characters. And it's interesting. When they need somebody to kind of come over and, you know, help intermediate with the United States, they go to the same guys who have been profiting on this. My understanding is that people came back and said, hey, the UN General Assembly is happening. It's opera season in New York. My schedule's full. And Wang Qishan said, hey, boys, I don't think you're listening. We're having a meeting. I want everybody to show up. This is general quarters. And so, no, I think when we look back on this, it's going to be, people are going to be absolutely stunned when they see how the elites, right, of the Western democracies and the United States went along with China and exacerbated a situation when it was quite evident they were at economic war with us.
Yeah. Going back on this one issue, the way that the influence is being pushed through the corporations, you know, we at our firm know that there are several, there's a couple of handfuls of corporations that each have more than $1 billion in capital that they're trying to get back from China, and they've been unable to get a dime out of China since November of 2016 when China closed its capital account completely. When you were in the administration, did you interface with any of these companies that were going through a lot of, pardon the pun, red tape, trying to get their money out of China?
The very first thing.
Did they come appeal to you?
Yeah, I think this will be a big shocker to people. Remember, when Trump won in a complete, you know, upset that nobody saw coming, and particularly you have this post-war, liberal, democratic, rules-based order, okay? The Chinese have done nothing but game the system from day one on every set of rules. The rules are what they determine they are.
Yeah.
Okay? And nobody calls them on it because everybody thinks they're too weak. And so in the corporations, I think until
the corporations are afraid to call them on it.
Absolutely.
Because they know if they say 100%. That we can't get our money out, they shut their business off.
They'll be shut down.
There's a quid pro quo.
Shut down. They absolutely fear it. Look at when they came back on this whole, by the way, on the entire situation with the tariffs, and tariffs are just not about tariffs and not about protectionism. That's why Trump's done it at such a scale. Remember, before Trump got here, people were talking about $25, $30 billion of tariffs. It was like, oh, my God, that's so huge. Trump's program is $500 billion in tariffs, right, the tariff goods, because he knows the Chinese can't respond.
Correct.
And here's why they can't respond. People in the United States have to understand one thing. The Chinese look at us as a tributary state to them, and let me explain that. China's been around for 4,000 years, right? They've had good runs and they've had bad runs, okay? But one thing they know, and the reason they're still organized as a nation over 4,000 years, right? They know how to handle allies and they know how to handle bad guys, okay? Now, what they've done is they've got this system called barbarian management, and they know how to manage barbarians. The way they manage the barbarians is they take the leaders of the barbarians and they give them a taste of the good life. And you're going to be something special. You're going to get a special deal. Now, what happens back into the tributary state is whatever happens, that's your problem.
Right.
Okay? So you're going to, in the United States, what they have done for 25 and 30 years is played as a barbarian state, barbarian management. Okay? They incentivize our elites, and our elites deindustrialize, particularly the upper Midwest of this country. It's the reason Donald Trump's president. Your audience should understand one thing that's important is that You know, J.D. Vance, the great guy from Yale who
Hillbilly
wrote
Elegy, yeah.
Hillbilly Elegies is the best sociological study of the Trump voter. Hmm. And it was J.D. Vance who told me, says, hey, those studies that come out of MIT and Harvard show that there's a direct correlation between the factories that left for China, the jobs that left with them, and the opioid crisis. Because this is not
about tariffs. It's actually logic.
It's not about tariffs. What this is about is human dignity and self-worth. Those factories went, Wall Street made the money, the corporations benefit from it for lower costs, and devil catch the hindmost on the workers. And so this is what Trump is kind of totally reversed. Now, what China sees us as is we're a tributary state. We send them natural resources, soybeans, beef, cattle, Boeing Airlines and Apple products. Oh, excuse me. We don't send Boeing Airlines and Apple products. You know why? Because they forced Boeing to do a joint venture and they forced Apple to make the products over there. So all we're Jamestown to their Great Britain. Mm. Okay. And that's why the tariffs at the scale that Trump put them up at, they can't respond to.
Steve Bannon, one of the most insightful, advisors to President Trump I think he's ever had. He's very, very well educated historically, got good business sense and so forth. So, it's too bad that, he's no longer in the White House, but the neocon didn't want him there at all, see. Because he was a good advisor and would advise Trump and I think what a lot of conservative people out here want. But, anyway, what we have now going on is, Trump put, tariffs against China. Now China's coming back and putting tariffs on some of our goods, but not on any kind of the same scale as President Trump has done. But, here we go now with, Trump talking about new tariffs. He's going up on the tariffs that we have against China now. So listen to that. Here we go.
Good evening. Welcome to Washington. I'm Brett Baer. Breaking tonight, serious punching and counterpunching taking place right now in what has become a full-fledged trade war between the U.S. and China. Within the past hour, President Trump has announced another major tariff increase on more than $500 billion of Chinese imports. He tweets, starting on October 1st, the $250 billion of goods and products from China, currently being taxed at 25%, will be taxed at 30%. Additionally, the remaining $300 billion of goods and products from China that was being taxed from September 1st at 10% now will be taxed at 15%, ending with, thank you for your attention to this matter. This comes after this morning word that Beijing hit the U.S. with $75 billion worth of new tariffs. The president responded by urging American firms to leave the world's most populous country. That earlier message sent the markets reeling. The Dow plummeting today 623 points. The S&P 500 lost 76. The Nasdaq plunged 240. For the week, the Dow lost 1 percentage point. The S&P 500 dropped almost 1.5. The Nasdaq lost a little less than 2. Today's events put an exclamation point on comments from the head of the Federal Reserve, who is rapidly becoming one of the president's favorite villains, that the trade situation is complicating his ability to deal with one of President Trump's favorite topics, interest rates. Correspondent Rich Edson starts us off tonight, a busy day on the North Lawn of the White House. Good evening, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Brett. And the president promised a response, and here it is. Another escalation in this trade fight between the United States and China. Officials say the president met with his trade advisors today. The result is this announcement and fears from global investors that the trade relationship between the two countries only gets worse from here. If you saw President Trump's Twitter feed today, you know the president has had enough with China. In a series of tweets, he stated, quote, "We don't need China and frankly would be far better off without them." China this morning announced tariffs on $75 billion of American products, setting off an initial market drop and the president of the United States. Trump says American companies, quote, "are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China." And Trump tweeted an order that, quote, "all carriers, including FedEx, Amazon, UPS, and the post office, to search for and refuse all deliveries of fentanyl from China or anywhere else." UPS and FedEx responded, saying they work with authorities and follow laws and regulations to intercept illegal shipments. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro defended the administration's stance.
We know that China steals massively from us. We know they're killing Americans with fentanyl. We know they manipulate their currency. So when Americans understand that, and then when China tries to bully us, that only strengthens our resolve.
Administration officials have described China as the United States' most significant global challenge and adversary. Despite that, the president asked, quote, "Who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi?" Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve President Trump selected. The president claims Powell and the Fed are constraining economic growth, refusing to lower interest rates further and faster.
My admonition to the Fed is don't play checkers in a chess world. Central banking around the world is a chess match.
Speaking before a major Fed conference in Wyoming, Powell threw it back on the president, saying uncertainty around trade is playing a role in the global economic slowdown. Quote, "While monetary policy is a powerful tool that works to support consumer spending, business investment, and public confidence, it cannot provide a settled rule book for international trade." Even as the markets tanked, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average spending the day hundreds of points in the negative, the president kept tweeting. At one point, he even joked, quote, "The Dow is down 573 points, perhaps on the news that Representative Seth Moulton, whoever that may be, has dropped out of the 2020 presidential race." Now, the White House had said trade negotiations are scheduled to resume next month with China. As to the president ordering American companies to disengage from China, the White House has offered no clarity on what authority a president of the United States has to compel an American business to move their operations out of another country. Brett?
Jetson, live on the North Lawn. Rich, thank you.
Now, during that interview, they brought up fentanyl. And the British had been importing for years opium into China and destroyed the country. So this is a got you back. This is a payback, a blowback. The fentanyl is that the Chinese are shipping into this country to destroy this country. The other point is that I should make is that the president has special executive powers for national security situations in calling back or keeping businesses from doing business overseas with so-called nation states that are considered to be dangerous to us or enemies to us and are threatening our national security. But you just can't redo these companies and call them back that quickly. I think President Trump has a bad habit of popping off and saying things and not considering the long-term strategic situations that for supply lines and all this other stuff that have to be set up. But there have been, when Steve Bannon in the earlier interview said that there have been the corporate sellout to China, he was right, and they started manufacturing things over in China to benefit their export situation. Now, coming up next is AOC stating making some pronouncements about the Electoral College, and she knows very little about that, and actually the Electoral College gives the working men out in the rural areas a say versus the highly populated inner cities. So here we go with what she said this week about the Electoral College.
Radical Dem Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calling for the abolishment of the Electoral College. She calls it a scam that hurts minorities. In a recent Instagram post, the congresswoman began by joking that she saw many votes while driving through the desert, which she sarcastically referred to as the Electoral College, nothing like wit. Joining us tonight, Cherie Murray, Republican challenger to Cortez, Ocasio-Cortez, for New York's 14th District. Great to have you here again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Where do you stand on the Electoral College? She's decided it's a scam rather than an integral part of this constitutional republic.
Well, this is a constitutional republic, Lou, and that's why our founding fathers put our Electoral College in place to ensure that rural states across this country has the opportunity to elect our president. If not without the Electoral College, we would have cities with high populations determining who our president is.
New York and
California.
And California, throw in maybe Florida and Texas would be running.
Correct.
The country. Let's listen to AOC as she talks about her perspective on the Electoral College.
We're coming to you live from the Electoral College. Many votes here, as you can see. Very efficient way to choose leadership of the country. I can't think of any other way, can you?
I get a kick out of her referring to efficiency as if that's the uppermost concern of a socialist is efficiency. Your thoughts?
Well, we need her in the district. And so this is, again, another indication of her just pandering to a constituency that didn't elect her into office. And
now,
so
we called both her local office, her district office, and the Washington office and didn't talk to all voicemail. Every other elected official we called just in this test had someone answering the phone.
Well, it's important. Constituent services.
Including Gerald Nadler, by the way.
I've
got to give him a shout out.
Constituent services are a key to serving your local community, Lou. And it's important to really be able to connect with the voters in the district.
You know, the last time we talked, you said that you didn't know if anybody in the district really knew her. That's obviously changing because it's hard to believe. She's only been in Congress now just about 8 months.
Yes.
She's reforming, changing, abolishing the Electoral College.
Yes, she wants to abolish ICE. She wants to abolish DHS. Yeah. She wants to abolish what we now see as our Electoral College. This type of rhetoric is dangerous.
And she's aligned with anti-Semitism if she's not an anti-Semite herself, because this business of attacking Israel is, it is
the back
shameless.
And forth that we just saw is, to your point, absolutely, it's shameful, and we need to stop this rhetoric. I call on AOC plus three, the squad, whatever you want to call them these days, to really take note that there's an international stage right now, and it's watching, and what you're doing is demonizing America, and that's wrong.
Well, this is going to be a clear test between you, the other aspirants to replace her, and AOC in your district.
We're ready for a primary, Lou, and we know that there are other candidates in the race, but we've certainly cleared the field, and I think she's taking our candidacy seriously. I would encourage your viewers to go to my website, SheriMurray.com. They can learn a little bit more about me and our platform, our policy positions. When we start to roll them out, they'll be the first ones to know.
All right. Sheri, always good to see you. Thanks
so
much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Lou.
Great, too. And look forward to seeing you again soon.
You got it.
Thank you.
Here's a panel discussion, and Charlie Heard is part of it. And it really lays out the problem with what she said, what AOC said about the Electoral College. So here's another panel discussion here that'll clear up a few things. Here we go now.
Joining me now for reaction is author of the book Still Winning, Washington Times opinion editor and Fox News contributor Charlie Hurt, along with Relatable podcast host Ali Beth Stuckey and Washington Examiner senior campaign reporter Kerry Pickett. So, Charlie, I'll go to you first. What I find comical about that AOC little home video she did there is she's a member of the House of Representatives, which is the branch of the Congress allocated by population. She seems to have missed that whole entire thing, like the whole federalism, electoral college, regional representation thing, right over her head, flew right over her head completely.
Yeah, and of course, the reason that's such a problem for us is the fact that the House of Representatives is, of course, the closest representation to the people. So for her to be ignorant on this is pretty disturbing. But I say to her, welcome to the discussion 200 years late. And of course, if she went back to a civics class, like in elementary school, and learned about this, she would learn that the whole point of this debate and the wisdom of our founders was to create a system that gave states enough power to balance out, to be a counterweight to the federal government. And when you look around at our country today and you look at all the problems with our government, the problems aren't in state governments usually. The problems are with the federal government. And if anything, what we need more of is more power given to those governments to act as a counterweight to the federal government. But all of that goes over her head, apparently.
Yeah, Ali, she seems to have missed the civics class with, you know, horizontal and vertical checks on power. You know, how within, you know, voting for the president, we didn't base it on the popular vote. We did an electoral college to preserve some sense of regional interest. You know, there are farmers in Wisconsin and, you know, as I said last night, citrus farmers in Florida who don't want to be voted out on a strict population direct democracy vote in their interest. She seems to have missed that entirely, yet she's one of the more prominent members of the U.S. Congress now, one of the biggest Twitter followers.
Well, she seems to miss a lot of classes, apparently civics class, economics class, could probably go on. But you're absolutely right. What I love is how transparent they are. They've talked about abolishing the Electoral College, getting rid of the Senate because that's not fair, maybe even making the case for getting rid of the Supreme Court. And we know what the theme is in all of that. Republicans control the Senate right now, and the Electoral College elected Donald Trump, and the Supreme Court has conservative justices on it. So we know exactly what their motive is. It's not because it's racist. That's actually the narrative that she was pushing on her Instagram stories, where she has millions of followers as well, that it was actually a racist scam. But we know what's really behind that. It's because they want control. She is perfectly fine with people in LA and San Francisco and New York City ruling over the rest of the country because they have the same ideology that she does. And of course, AOC knows best.
You know, Carrie, what I find mildly amusing about this, almost in kind of a tragic way, is this is really not good for a Democrat Party that's having a tough time right now attracting working class Americans. They're really becoming the party of the elites, the Democrats. I mean, you see it in San Francisco. It's a totally bifurcated city right now. And yet she goes on in the video pointing out, you know, what could be any portion of America that's not densely populated like the Bronx and Queens. And she just sits there and takes a shot at it, as if we're not important enough if we're not big time city dwellers like her. I mean, what kind of silly political strategy is this?
Absolutely, Dan. Think about this. You have Joe Biden as well as a number of other primary Democrats who are trying to pick up a number of voters all over the country. And here you have AOC, who is in her car saying, oh, the Electoral College, it is just not that fair. I mean, come on now. We here on these coastal states, you know, we should be getting better representation. Now, keep in mind, this is sort of the cry of individuals who lost the last election. And, you know, this isn't really unusual. This has been going on, believe it or not, since 1804. Nearly every single Congress has tried to reform the Electoral College since 1804. So this is how a loser cries, essentially.
Charlie, if someone like Biden, who's at least pretending to be a moderate, wins the nomination, after that nomination process is over, you know he's going to track back to the middle, of course, because there's just no, you know, votes to win nationally for a 90% tax rate and health care for illegal immigrants. What does Biden do with AOC and the squad? I mean, how does he handle that? Does he distance himself from them? And if he does, how does he then get that leftist base that's all excited about them to show up at the polls?
Well, I think that you put your finger on something that I think is the most important story today, and that is that, yeah, it's obvious that Democrats like AOC are doing a lot to damage the party in the eyes of sort of a general election electorate. But my goodness, I think they're destroying their own Democratic base, because there are a lot of rank-and-file regular Democrat voters out there, and these are the people that you see registered in the polls favoring Joe Biden, who don't support. These are Democrats now. They're people who don't like Donald Trump, and they can give you legitimate reasons for not liking him. They have nothing to do with Russia or racism. They have to do with other policy positions. And they're completely not represented by any of these loons in the Democratic Party who are racing to the left to give free health care to illegal aliens. And Bill de Blasio wants to give New York City housing to illegal aliens. There are a lot of rank-and-file Democrats who are looking at that saying, this is not for me. And I think Donald Trump picks up a lot of those people come general election. But, you know, before that, in the Democratic primary, I think it hurts the party.
This AOC and the squad are ruining. I think the panel discussion heard is right. Charlie Heard is right. They're ruining the Democratic Party, where the moderate Democrat is being ruined. So now coming up next, we have a scandal going on with Peter Byrne, and he's the former chief executive officer, newly resigned from Overstock. And he was interviewed by Martha McCallum earlier this week, and we're going to play a clip of that. But his story goes something like that he'd been working with the Men in Black and the FBI and trying, and this Butina woman, Maria Butina, that's been jailed before spying for the Russians and so forth, that he worked with her and had some kind of a dalliance or some kind of a romantic encounter. And they told, the FBI told him to keep it going, and the man, it's a really convoluted story. So I'm going to play some of that and then sort of make a synopsis, and I'll give a click off on my site, thesecrettruth.com. Go there and you'll be able to play the full interview. But here we go with Martha McCallum.
So obviously you stepped away from your company, you say for the good of the company and the good of
yes.
the country. You say that you got tangled up in the deep state investigation into President Trump. Tell me, how did all of this start?
Let me give you the bottom line up front. So listen, I'm a hippie. I have nothing to do with the feds. I'm a flag-waving hippie. Twice in my life I had the honor of helping them. A friend of mine named Brian Williams was murdered. 17 years ago, I helped them bring the murder to justice, and I helped them fight Wall Street about 12 years ago. I was kind of a one-man Occupy Wall Street in 05, 06. The Fed showed up, and it was my honor to help them take down a couple hundred people on Wall Street. So that's that. Let me jump to the bottom line, and this I've learned is the quickest way to explain it. In 2015, 2016, they got back in touch with me for the third time, and it was... I was given some fishy orders, and I carried them out in 2015, 2016, thinking I was conducting law enforcement. Let me emphasize, don't say the FBI. The FBI is barely involved in this. It's all the top. The men in black, as I called them, showed up and asked for this third favor. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the details right now, but I didn't know who sent the orders, but I did them. They seemed fishy last summer watching television. And here's the punchline, people. Last summer watching television and some congressional hearings, I figured out where those orders came from. I gave them a guy named Peter Strzok. And Bill Freestab, Carlin, McCabe, Comey. That was who sent the orders. And
well, you're naming a bunch of FBI people there.
Well, the Peter Strzok, and it has been confirmed to me that my instructions came from Peter Strzok, that the people who carried me the orders were coming at the taking on behalf. That's been confirmed.
So you had helped the government a couple of times. They reached out to you. What did they ask you to do?
I don't want to go into the nitty-gritty right now. I can tell you the main event, and I feel terrible. I've been watching for 3 years, and our country's coming apart, and people are killing each other. And I finally went to see Buffett. And Buffett's kind of my rabbi, I call him. And he said, Patrick, you have to come forward. And I said, you know, it's going to make some feds furious at me. Their heads are going to explode. And he said, you let feds do their job. You're a citizen. You got your job. You're coming to the public. Here's what it is. This was all political espionage conducted against Hillary Clinton, Rubio, Cruz, and Trump. This is not a theory of mine, some political theory. I was in the room when it happened, in a way. I mean, not in a way. I was part of it. I didn't know. I knew I had some of the pieces. I thought I had the pieces of something much bigger. Last summer, as stuff bubbled into the news, thanks to good journalists such as yourself, I started realizing I had these very important missing pieces. I actually started trying to help then, but I had to wait until there was a return to rule of law in our country. And I've lived in places where there ain't, and that took waiting until Bill Barr got installed. And then I don't know the guy, I never shaken his hand or anything, but only then did I trust things enough. And I went to the Department of Justice and started
explaining. And you told
them
what you knew.
It's
my understanding that you know, I should just point this out because some people might be listening and saying, you know, well, how credible is this? And, you know, we did some asking around and, you know, we have basically had the indications that, you know, that there's every reason to believe that your story is indeed credible. So
I'm not in the convincing business. I'm
yeah,
in the
no,
business
I,
of,
I, I
I'm
hear you.
The door,
and obviously,
open,
but let me go back to the basics, because this is what everybody's saying at home. This is what everyone's saying at home. What did they tell you to do? What did they ask you to do, Patrick?
There was, well, some of it
involved this young lady, Maria Butina, who came here. So some of it involved her.
Okay.
Some of it involves setting up Hillary Clinton for what looked like looked like law enforcement was actually setting her up to be blackmailed. I helped set them set up Hillary Clinton to be blackmailed.
What was the nature of the blackmail?
Can't go into it. And so I'm sure there's a bunch of people in Washington who are going to rip me apart. And I've actually been warned. I was warned last October from a friendly person, Patrick, if you come forward, this entire town of Washington is going to destroy you. It's going to turn you into dust.
And, you know, I give you a lot of credit because I know that you said that you did some soul searching over the summer and you talked to good friends, and you mentioned one of them a moment ago. What was the nature of your relationship with Maria Butina? Did she reach out to you or did you reach out to her? And how involved were you? Did you have an affair with her for 3 years, or what was the nature of your relationship?
Have you seen the video? I bet you've played it, where candidate Trump is at a conference and this young girl stands up and asks her a question.
Sure.
If you go and look up that conference, which was a 2015 conference in Las Vegas, I'm a small L libertarian, a small R Republican. I don't even identify as a Republican. I get asked to speak at sort of freedom-oriented conferences like that, mm-hmm. and I did. And I was at that conference, and after I spoke, she actually came up to me and talked about guns. Well, and some gun rights thing in Florida, and the first time I brushed her off, I'm not into guns. Everybody should have one, but I'm not into them. I don't fetishize them or anything like Republicans, but I often do. But then she came up the next day and said, listen, I'm really here. Look, I'm really here. I've been sent from Russia to make contact with you. And there's some people in Russia who want to talk to you. They know about you and your relationship with Milton Friedman. Believe it or not, there are people like this in Russia. There are liberals. Anyway, she had this whole story. I don't want to get into it here. I'll put it up on a website called Deep Capture, which is where I used to write to the world. But I'll go into all the – I don't want to go into the where in the doll did you touch her stuff. We had an intellectual relationship. I was given a green light to meet her again. She turned that into a physical relationship. I don't mean to, not that I'm unwitting, so we dated for about 6 months. I was trying to yenter her in to some senior foreign policy thinkers. Because of some things I used to do involving law enforcement and taking down Wall Street, I used to have a very low level security clearance. And when you get that, you sign a piece of paper that says when a gal comes up to you from Russia and says, listen, I've been sent here to make contact with you, and we want to take you to Moscow and want you to speak on Bitcoin and speak on liberalism at the central bank, and then we want other people. You have to report that. I reported that, and so that to my clearance authority, and which is kind of I talked about once every 3 years or something like that happened. And before I know it, the men in black are back in my life. And I was trying to encourage her to have a relationship. And she wanted to be a back channel for peace. And I could have opened some doors, but I didn't want to do that until I had some green light. And after a couple months, I was given the green light. That turned romantic. I was bothered. I'll tell you something I'll tell you some really deep stuff. I was two-thirds judging it as an opportunity for something good, something to move the ball of peace down the field a bit. Mm-hmm. One-third that it was a risk. I know she was dating or living with some Republican bigwigs and stuff. So my deal, I just said, I'm a 56-year-old bachelor. I said, you just, every 6 weeks or so, when you want to see someplace, give me a call and we'll meet there. But I was trying to yenter her in and maybe something peaceful could happen. But I had sort of a third, maybe two-thirds I was positive, one-third this is quite a risk. And especially over those, from July of 2015 to March of 2016, she clearly was swanking around more and more in big shot Republican circles, mm-hmm. including people like Don Jr. I was telling her that the men in black about all those meetings before she had them. They knew about her the day she landed. They knew about every one of these meetings she had. They knew that at one point she was going off to have a meeting with Don Jr. I don't know. And listen, I didn't vote for Trump. I'm not a never Trumper. He won fair and square, and that's.
So do you think she was set up by the Men in Black to approach people in the Trump administration? Is that a possibility?
100%. They knew that she was trying to approach, and her instructions were she had to build a contact with anyone in the Hillary campaign, Rubio, Cruz, or Trump. And they knew that because she told me, and I let them know. They let it all happen. I could have told you in December of 2015, I had a suspicion forming in my mind. It was really quite strange because she had initially checked off. She doesn't like, she's Democrat. She's much more of a Republican or much more of a small L liberal. She's a Milton Friedman fan. I'm a Milton Friedman guy. So once she had checked off having met somebody in Clinton's circle, I don't know who, and she was telling me all this, she was just going to focus on Cruz, Rubio, and Trump. At that point, the interest in the United States government in doing anything about this went to zero. It became like this, even to the point I was telling them things like, look, she's telling me that in a matter of weeks she's going to be at some conference of conservatives, and Donald Trump is going to be taken down and out the back door of his hotel and be taken to meet her and this and that. What do you want me to do? Can I let me take her off for a trip and whisk her away to the Bahamas?
Yeah.
Or what? And they said, no, we're going to let it all happen.
Uh-huh.
100%.
So do you believe that she was working for them, for these men in suits in the United States, or that she was working for the Russian government? Or some combination.
No, I'm not going into that. She wasn't working for the men in suits here. Listen, here's the other main event. It's horrible to even say the initials FBI involved in this. It wasn't the FBI. The FBI got hijacked from the top. It's the top. It's entirely
the top. Well, you talked
about
Comey. You talked about Brennan Clapper. So you're talking about the CIA?
I've said there's three officials whose names were used with me, X, Y, and Z. I'm not going to say on your show. The feds all have this. The legitimate feds all have this as of April. Mm-hmm. There were three names used at the three senior officials. Right. They were behind all this. And the FBI was out of it. The FBI, they delivered the message. And let me tell you, and then there was another period where they told me to break up with her. Yeah. I was stage four or stuff. They came back, and this time they specifically said, we need you to conduct a romantic, rekindle your romantic relationship, and the orders are coming from X, Y, and Z. And they felt horrible. I want to be clear. These are men and women of honor, and I think those are illegal orders. And they made very clear to me, you do not have to take these. You do not have to help. I think they didn't want me to, but they felt terrible.
So when you say all the way up, are you talking, what do you mean? The White House? The CIA?
I think you're
talking about
names.
Entities that were separate from these. Like when you say it wasn't the FBI, but you say it was Peter Strzok, are you sort of carving him out as being part of a separate operation, separate from the FBI?
No. I'm just, forget Strzok for a moment. The X, Y, and Z are actual human beings whose names you know, who were in the Obama administration. Guys like Strzok and stuff are the errand boys. They're the clerks who sent the messages for some federal agents.
Is it John Brennan? Is it James Clapper? Is it
General Barr? General Barr has that information, and
okay.
I think they're already, I'm sure, furious. I've way overstepped the lines.
All right, I understand,
They'll reveal it to you.
Okay, I'm asking questions because that's my job, and you can answer them to whatever extent you feel comfortable, and I understand that. But when you say that you realized last summer that it was Peter Strzok that had contacted you, and you've talked about having discussions about Maria Butina, did something make you uncomfortable that he asked you to do, and is that why you sort of said
No, it didn't work that way.
Okay.
I will write up an explanation of all of this, and people can read it, so it's clear. But it was what was making me uncomfortable was two things. That I was, I had originally said, hey, this is two-thirds an opportunity, and something, she's very well connected in Russia. Let me introduce her to some people in our foreign policy think tank establishment, and would that be okay? One-third, she wanted to talk about John Stuart Mill and Erasmus and the Greeks. I mean, she's a real intellectual. But I had this concern about the risk that there was some mischief afoot, and she was here doing what Well, as those first 6 months wore on, that risk profile shifted. And she stopped talking so much about John Stuart Mill and John Rawls and Milton Friedman as she started talking about all these Republican bigwigs she's swanking around with. I could have told you, I'm looking for a prop, I could have told you in December of 2015, I was forming this thought, it's starting to seem what they're doing. Is now that they know she's here just swimming around with Republicans, it's starting to seem that what they're doing is letting this can-o scandal develop on the Republicans, and someday they're going to pick it up and shake it, crack it, and spray it on the Republicans. Nah, no way. No way would James Comey, no way would President Obama ever do something like that. That's literally what, and I'm not saying President Obama was involved. Don't make any assumptions about who X, Y, and Z are. Those are all up to the DOJ involved. But I literally, I could have told you in December 2015, which I will note is 7 months before the official start of the investigation, that I had already picked up. I was already hypothesizing this is starting to seem like they're just deliberately letting this grenade develop on the Republicans. Are they just going to pull the pin on it someday?
I hear you.
I could, you know.
Was there anything that you witnessed that, you know, or were you ever told to stand down, you know, to back off? Is that what you were referring to a little while ago, or was that something different?
No, in March of 2016, I was. She asked me over to Russia to give a speech. Her goal was to get me to Moscow to give a talk at the central bank on Bitcoin and liberalism, and then to take me to a resort in the Altai Mountains that was going to be shut down for 3 days so that 40 to 45 people would get together from the oligarchs and the governments and their liberals, and we're going to spend 3 days talking about liberalism and also... Anyway, this was the offer, and she had been sent by them to get me to come back and do this.
Yeah.
When she asked me in March to come over again, she was saying, speak in St. Petersburg on blockchain, and I think that we can change the world and eliminate poverty and stuff with blockchain. Come speak. Putin is going to be there. It's been arranged. You're going to have 60 minutes alone with Putin, and this will be great. At that point, I was told, break up with her and get her out of your life. And I worked on something else involving corruption of a federal official.
Okay.
When that was... Okay.
No, go ahead. When that?
When that matter involving the corruption of a federal official was complete, it ended in an odd way that sounded fishy. It ended in an odd way that was very fishy. And again, the details are all in the Department of Justice. And but it was involved in a corruption of a federal official, and it ended in a way that smelled like skunk. At which point, when they came back around July 1st of 2016, which is to say a few weeks before the Republican convention, but about the time that Trump became the
nominee,
presumptive nominee,
yeah.
Not nominee, but they came back and said, boy, did we make a mistake. Russia. We need to do it. And I want to be clear, they said this. They said the United States never, ever asked this of somebody. Never asked a citizen to conduct a romantic relationship in order to get information. This is such a national security emergency. We need to ask you to do this if you're willing. And the orders come from X, Y, and Z. We want to be clear, Patrick. You are absolutely in your rights to refuse this. You have no obligation to. We never, in all our careers, we've never heard of an American citizen being asked to sleep with someone in order to get information and such. I want to be clear about something. And so then I conducted, for the following 7 months, I, to all intents and purposes, conducted another romance. That entire time I was lying to the federal government. I put on a show. I was flying her, wanting and dying her. That second time I spent time with her, I created the impression deliberately that I was complying with the request and being romantic. What I was actually doing, and she has confirmed this, I understand, from a prison cell. She has no... You know, she could have every right to hate me. I understand she's confirmed a journalist. I was a total gentleman. Anyone observing and surveilling would have thought that we were deeply in love. I never laid a finger on her because I knew it would disgrace our country and it would disgrace Maria. And that entire period that I was being instructed to romance her, I created the impression, but it was all a lie. And I did that, and at the same time, I set up X, Y, and Z for some felony charges.
Okay. I just have two quick questions for you. One is, what made you realize last summer that the person who was contacting you was Peter Strzok?
Well, he wasn't contacting. Well, let me be clear. Some people showed up and said, these instructions come, and this request comes. It was things... Because I had been involved, I deliberately kept, once this Russia scandal started, believe it or not, I tried as much as I could not to follow it, because I wanted to keep my own mind clear for when the investigators showed up. And we should talk about that too. But when the investigators showed up, so my mind would be clear. So I really tried not to follow it as hard as I could. By last May or June, I mean, it became impossible, and I felt very awful because I knew I had these very important pieces. I actually went to see a lawyer, and the lawyer, who's a big Republican lawyer, he was all excited. I'm going to take, you know, I said, I need to come forward to somebody, help me. And he heard about 5 minutes of my story, and he said, Patrick, you're going to go home and you're going to keep your mouth shut. You're going to go to prison for the rest of your life if you come forward. But the next month, it was watching the congressional hearing ripping these guys apart, mm-hmm. that there were little details that were said that made me realize, holy cow, this guy Peter Strzok is the guy who sent these instructions. And his little details within the things that were said, and they have since confirmed to me more recently, yes, you're correct in what you figured out.
All right, last question. What do you say to folks who watch this and they say, you know, he's spinning a yarn?
Listen, I've put everything on the line. I was warned that I'm going to be destroyed by this, that all of Washington is going to try to grind me into dust. I had to eject from the company. I had to eject. I can't bring that on the company. If you want to help me, you go buy your daughter a pillow at Overstock.com. The entirety of Washington is going to come down on me and try to destroy me. So I had to get out of the way. That's what's happened. And
no doubt, Peter Strzok would watch this and say, you know, he's full of it. I had nothing to do with anything that he's talking about. I would imagine.
He won't. I can tell you, Peter Strzok, you want to see a former director crap his pants? Pardon me. Go stick a television camera on Peter Strzok, or let's just say James Comey, and say the name Patrick Byrne. You will see a former director of the FBI crap his pants.
All right. Well, we thank you for coming here tonight and telling your story, and we'll obviously follow it as it moves forward. Thank you very much.
Shop Overstock. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Patrick Byrne joining us tonight. Good to see you, sir. Also here tonight, Matthew Whitaker, the former acting U.S. Attorney General. Matthew, your thoughts on what Mr. Byrne had to say?
Well, again, I mean, he tells an interesting story, but it's light on specifics, and so we're going to have to wait and hear exactly what these specifics are. But the good news is the one person who needs those specifics, John Durham, has them. And I believe that Bill Barr and John Durham are going to give full transparency to the American people as to the origins of this investigation. And if these things all line up and we hear the full story, then we may look back at this video as a great opportunity to hear directly from somebody that was involved in this investigation.
So let me ask you about this, because this whole question of Maria Butina, who is doing 18 months in prison, and she... because she didn't register as a foreign agent. What did you think about the part of the story where he says, you know, that the assets told him that he, yes, please go ahead, have this, you know, relationship with her, go to the meeting with her, and report back to us. And then when she started sort of reaching out to these Republican entities and sort of heading more in that direction, it sounds like, at that point, when he started asking questions, they said, you know, hands off. We don't want to talk about any of that.
Well, typically, I mean, he's describing it like he was being used as a source and being inserted into a situation mm-hmm. by the feds. And there are protocols for handling sources, and there will be recorded 302s and the like. And so, I mean, all of this can be corroborated, and that's the key, is, you know, this whole situation has to be corroborated. And the nice thing about John Durham is he has the full picture of everything that was feeding into this investigation.
Do you think that he's credible?
It's hard for me to say, you know, but, you know, one of the
nice
things...
Were you aware of him when you were at the DOJ?
Only that I knew of the company Overstock, and that was only as a citizen that buys stuff off the Internet. So, you know, it was not a name that crossed my transit. But remember, I was supervising the Mueller investigation,
right.
And we weren't looking at the origins until we had the investigation done and the report filed.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he was ever asked any questions by the Mueller investigation. Do you think that's odd?
A little bit. I do. I think the question here boils down to, in 2016, why did the feds let this entire Russian interference operation continue without abatement. And that's kind of what this whole story feeds into. And in 2018 and 2020, I think you're going to see the Trump administration do a much different effort against these interference efforts than we saw Obama do in 2016. And that's the real story here, I think.
And as you point out, he has turned over his story to John Durham. That investigation is ongoing. We do not know what they will find. We gave him an opportunity to tell his side of the story here tonight. And we'll see, you know, what comes of all of it, as you say. Matt Whitaker, great having you listening in to all of that and commenting on it tonight. Thank you. Good to see you.
This interview that Martha McCallum did on her program, she was called back on several of the other Fox networks to comment. We want to thank you for listening tonight. We're not going to leave with any exit music tonight. We're using every second that we have. Thank you. God bless each and every one of you. Good night.